Hi, Brad here. Later in this episode, you're going to hear me refer to a live episode that is going to be done on Saturday, July 24th of 2021. Unfortunately, unforeseen circumstances, that show is not going to happen. There will not be a live episode. However, we will be back for our regular show next Tuesday, July 27th. And we'll see you then. Thank you for your understanding. In this episode, hear what rating Justine gives to her recommendation, a novel that includes Nazis and the occult, and Chris Holcomb is my guest, who talks about The Double Vice, a novel that will transport you into 1920s Greenwich Village and Harlem. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Before we begin, I want to let you all know that Justine is such a trooper. I don't think she's ever missed a recording session. She has a lot going on, and I told her, don't worry, I'll wing it. And despite everything going on, she is here.
Hi, Brad. You know I don't like to let people down.
And you didn't let me down. I'm grateful to see you here.
Well, at least hear me, yes. I don't want to let the listeners down either. I like to believe people want me on here.
Trust me, based on the emails and such, they do, yes.
Oh, good. See, I fished for that compliment and it came right up.
I got a quick announcement before we get to your recommendation.
Okay.
This Saturday, July 24th, we are going to be live for the very first time. It's a loose network of queer podcasts called Pride 48, and there will be live shows all weekend. Big Gay Fiction Podcast is part of the network, but they won't be on live, unfortunately. But our friends Mike and Kyle over at Gayish will be. They're going to have a live show that weekend. Our show, Queer Writers of Crime, will be on Saturday, July 24th, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time.
Well, you know, Brad, when it's live, I can't really run it on my schedule, so I won't actually show up that week. But I think that the surprise replacement will really please people.
I think so, too. In fact, I'm going to tell them, when Justine told me there's no way she could do this live episode, she said, this is the person who's going to do it. And it wasn't like a, this is the person I want to do it. It was, this is the person who's going to do it. So you'll see next Saturday, listen in, and you'll find out who the guest book recommendation is. Dur is, I guess that's a word.
Yeah.
It is now. And don't worry, we will be back on again next Tuesday as well. Got some different things going on then.
But you can tell who the guest on the live performance is.
Yes, it's going to be Marco Romante.
Yes.
He is back. Is this the second time he's been on or the third?
This is the second time he's been on, but it's with his third book.
Okay, it's the second time he's got on. And I will tell you this, he has some big news.
Boy, there's a lot of teasing with this episode. People, you know, and I got to say, the people should not think we're overhyping it. I think people are going to be very pleased on both accounts.
Let me just say one thing. You'll listen on TuneIn Radio, which they have an app, also a website. I will leave the link in the show notes. I probably could have not said that. They would have figured it out on their own. But please listen in. Okay. It's your turn, Justine. Go for it.
All right. So I have been looking for this series for a long time. I remembered enough about it and how great it was, but I couldn't quite come up with the author or the name of the series. And I have finally found it. I went back so far in my Kindle history that I have finally found the series. And this series started in May 22nd of 2012. And it has four books in it. And the last one came out on March 5th, 2016. So I bought the first book on March 21st, 2016. And I bought the fourth book on March 22nd, 2016. And I bought them as I finished them. So you can see just how much I loved this series.
Yeah, it sounds like you liked it okay.
Yeah, I liked it okay. But This author, unfortunately, I haven't found anything he's written since then, which is too bad. I don't know if he has put stuff out under another pen name or not, but it's an excellent series. Well, let me tell you about it. It's the
Who is the author?
The author is Alex Fiano. The first book in the series was put out under A.R. Fiano. It is extremely well written. It's getting my glowing recommendation. Gabriel's World is the name of the series. The first book is called The Hangman, The Hanged Man, H-A-N-G-E-D, man, and it's tied in with the tarot. The Hangman is a tarot card, and each of the chapters starts out with a description of an applicable tarot card. Gabriel is a private investigator. The book starts with him having just gotten out of jail. He was arrested for attacking a reverend, and this fictional reverend, I'm sure, will be familiar to many. The reverend led a church who was protesting at the funeral of one of Gabriel's friends. So this was a military veteran, and the church members showed up and were protesting outside her funeral, calling her a dyke, and he left the funeral, came over, and punched the reverend. It was a highly well-covered in the press, rather famous incident in this book. And he is let out with and this is called ACD in that part of the country, where if you stay out of trouble for 6 months, they'll drop the charges. So he's really trying to stay out of trouble, which means he doesn't want to get caught being in trouble. He's still causing trouble. A lawyer picks him up in a limo from the courthouse steps and drives him back to New York. And along the way, the lawyer says he wants to hire him. The lawyer is on the board of a foundation, a Jewish Studies Foundation, and he wants to hire him because one of the board members is connected to a Nazi. And while the lawyer knows this, the lawyer has no proof and wants Gabriel to find the proof. About an hour after the lawyer drops him off, the lawyer disappears. There's video of the lawyer having coffee with some man in a cap and dark glasses. Raymond gets sick. The lawyer gets sick. The disguised man takes him out of there. And the next time Raymond is seen, he is found in his bed at his apartment, apparently dead by auto asphyxiation accident, which Gabriel can see is staged. And Gabriel has broken into the lawyer's apartment while the lawyer has been missing. And he knows the lawyer wasn't in there. And he knows the lawyer hasn't been there for 3 days, dead. The police, of course, suspect him of the crime. That's part of why he has to investigate. But Raymond, who's the lawyer, his partner, has hired Gabriel to prove that it was a homicide because his partner wants to take away the reputation damaging of the suicide or the accident of autoerotic asphyxiation. So he's got some money to follow this up. He's got money for experts and the like. His investigation takes him into Nazi secret societies, and it takes him into the small cult organizations that were involved with the Nazi secret societies. And he gets entangled in a variety of conspiracy theories. He likes conspiracy theories, a trait I share with him. He doesn't believe most of them, but this conspiracy theory has a basis in fact. So they spend a lot of time researching. He ends up hooking up with a news reporter, a highly refined Indian gentleman, and also on the scene is his former boyfriend, who shows up at just the right time to give him just the right help and also to try to seduce him again into the relationship. So he's got a lot going on. There's a lot of competing threads in this book. All of them are well developed. All of them, they fit together like puzzle pieces. There's nothing left hanging ever. And it's a wild ride. Very well written. Has the glowing recommendation. And I think people will really, really like this series. There's no paranormal in it. It's just an exploration of the organizations that were researching the occult and trying to use the occult to help the Nazis. It's a great book, and it's a great series. I read it in literally a day and a half, and it's stuck with me this whole time, and I finally dug far enough back that I could pull it out for people. And I've reread the first book, and it holds up as well as I remember.
And I think you have some stuff from Requeered Tales today.
I do. We are publishing our first original book. It is by Felice Picano. It is called Betrothal at Usk. It's his science fiction book. It is the second book in the trilogy, which Dryland's End was published back in the 90s. We republished it earlier this year. And this one of his most critically acclaimed books, and people who read it have always asked him to, you know, when is he going to publish the sequel? And it's finally found a home at Requeered Tales. It's our first original book, and it is now available for pre-order. It's called The Betrothal at Usk, U-S-K.
Good job to y'all for getting a first published book. That's awesome.
It is awesome. It's terrific.
I think it'll be the first of many.
Well, let me just say, first published books are a lot harder to get out than republished books. So,
well, let me just say, it's the first of many, if that's what you want.
Well, you know, we've got more on the line, and I think people will enjoy them. And when it comes to republished books, we're releasing the next book in Lev Raphael's Nick Hoffman series, and that's going to be on pre-order in the next week or two.
Sounds great. Thank you, Justine. And I will talk to you next week. And thank you. Thank you for making it in your schedule.
All right. Good
Take
to
care.
See you again, Brad.
We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com. So, Chris, are you all Jake for the interview?
I am all Jake for the interview.
One thing I loved about your novel, The Double Vice, is you used a lot of idioms and slangs from the 1920s. And I have this thing, writers like to sometimes, somebody will be speaking in a foreign language, you don't know what they're talking about. It's just a sentence there to try and make it sound authentic. Or they'll use slang from a time period where you have no clue as to what they're saying. And what I really liked about your book is the way the word is used in your sentences, you know exactly what they're talking about. I guess Jake is common still in Australia. I had to look it up. But it's definitely fallen out of favor here in the United States. So I read it and I knew right away it meant everything's cool or everything's fine. The blurb for The Double Vice says it's the shadowy world of drag queens, cabaret performances, gangsters, mob moles, lesbian lawyers, and a mysterious but dangerous baroness of business. And if that's not enough, I don't know what is, and that is not a lie. It's all in there. Let's go ahead with your introduction. Chris Holcomb is an author of LGBTQ plus historical crime fiction. The Double Vice is the first novel in his Hidden Gotham series, which showcases New York's lively but criminally underrepresented queer world of the 1920s. He is also an award-winning songwriter, winning Best Folk Song at the 2009 Hollywood Music and Media Awards, as well as an accomplished brand strategist in marketing and advertising. He lives with his husband in New York. I'm going to get away from the book for a second here because something just jumped out at me. So you won an award for a song, and you are a brand strategist in marketing and advertising. Any chance that you've written jingles?
I wish. You know, the jingles are no longer in fashion hardly anymore, which is so sad to me because I would have loved to write, like, you know, for Double Mint. You remember the Double Mint commercials and
yes,
and whatnot. But I, funny enough, my undergrad was Berklee College of Music, and I did take jingle writing with a guy named John Aldridge, who wrote all the jingles. I think he wrote mostly for McDonald's. So I did study it. I never got a chance to pull it through, sadly. But you know what? If there's an opportunity to write a jingle, I will do it in a heartbeat.
It's funny that it's fallen out of favor because they definitely stuck in your head. They worked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They totally worked. But yeah, it's funny how things kind of worked out. But
I hope you get the day to write that jingle.
Me too.
I gotta say, I really tried hard not to get overly excited when I'm talking to an author, because I just like to talk about the book and I don't want to make one guest feel more welcome than the other. I'm going to do it this. I'm going to break my rule this time. I loved The Double Vice. Justine did a book recommendation for it. And when I told her you were going to be on the show, sometimes I don't tell her who the guest is, just not to keep it a secret. We just don't talk about it. But I mentioned you were going to be on and she said, I loved his book. And now I know why.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. And a huge part of it is I love history. I'm a big history nut. But I'm not a history nut in the sense I could care less about all the wars and the battles and the royalty. I want to know what everyday folks were doing as a general rule. And that's really what you got into. You got into, as you said, a part of history that's not represented enough or not told enough. And that's the kind of history I'm really into. I studied 2 years, and this was on my own time. It wasn't for college or anything. For 2 years, I did an in-depth study on the settling of the Midwest and the city planning and real estate scams that were going on. That's how much I like those everyday occurrences more than the big ones that you read about in the history books. So you took me there. And I want to say, I'll read a book. I enjoy reading it, but I know I'm reading a novel about that era. And I've read novels about the Victorian era and the 60s and the 50s. And your novel takes place in 1926. And I wasn't reading a novel about 1926. You took me in to 1926. Like, I felt like a participant.
Well, thank you. I worked really hard at that. I worked really hard at that because one of the things that I've actually not a big historical crime fiction reader myself. Mm-hmm. I actually read more present day, although some of the stuff I read now is like takes place in the 80s and early 90s. So I guess it could be historical fiction nowadays. But I wanted it to read like it was written in present day. That was kind of my approach. So all I did was when I was on a certain day in a certain scene, I would read articles in the New York Times from that day, articles from that week of the New Yorker, which I've got access to all the archives that go all the way back to the 1920s. And that was it. And I didn't want to put in like, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, irony about we know what's going to happen 100 years from now. I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to feel very present. So I'm very pleased to hear that from you, that I took you in there, because that was my intent. I wanted it to feel not like you were reading something historical, but that you were reading something as if it was happening right now, in the sense of you were in that narrative. So that was my intent, and I'm glad I pulled it off.
I really liked the way you made it fit in that I didn't have to wonder what they meant. But I will tell you, it threw me out of the story at times because I was like, wow, I've never heard that term before. And I knew exactly what you're talking about, but I'm like, I want to find out the background of this. So I quickly got on the computer and I'd look it up and find out when it started and how long it lasted and where it came from. It's obvious you did a lot of that research.
Yeah, absolutely. I found a lot of different slang dictionaries. I even found a slang dictionary that was written by Cab Calloway.
Oh.
That talked about, so you could learn how to talk hep, as it were, which I guess would mean hip nowadays. But it was really fun to look at and find some of these terms. I actually, on my Instagram, I feature a Word Wednesday where we go through a couple of series of words or phrases, just kind of like show it off and educate it. Some of the more out there ones that I wouldn't necessarily put in the book because it would take you too far out of the story where you'd go, what in mm-hmm. the world is that? So there are some really interesting ones, but I was surprised at how much of the slang that was developed in the 20s we still use today. It's really interesting to see how some things kind of carried over into present day. I think bee's knees lasted for a long time before it quickly mm-hmm. kind of fell out of fashion, but it lasted for a while and a couple of others. But I think like dime notes and nickel notes,
I think people still know bee's knees, but it's more in a kind of a joking manner that they'll say it, not like it was regularly used back in the past.
That's true. That's very true.
We're going to talk about your book, and we're going to talk about your protagonist, Dash Parker. But I want to start from the very beginning of the book. you had notes from the author, and in it you kind of wanted to explain the slang terms you were going to be using and that were commonly used at the time. And you mentioned that heterosexual, homosexual, and bisexual were not terms used then, and that terms that today would be offensive, like fairies and pansies, weren't necessarily offensive back then. Can you speak a little on that? Because you said you kind of used, I think it was fairies that said, you said, was used much more than you did in the book because you didn't want to be offensive. But
yeah,
talk a little bit more about that.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things when you're looking at, and we're talking about the terms that the homosexual community, or the queer community, excuse me, would be referred to and refer to themselves as. And back then, a lot of that identity or a lot of those terms were based upon gendered appearance. And so I wanted to make sure that people understood that, because nowadays, obviously, you know, with the conversation about like with non-binary and gender non-conforming and gender queer, you know, this is going to be a little bit alien, I think, to newer types of readers. So I wanted to let them give them a heads up that that was occurring. But then I also wanted to make sure that I didn't use terms that would be wildly offensive today, even if they weren't offensive back then, because I didn't want to take the reader out of the story and I didn't want them to get hurt by it. That's something that I didn't want to do. At the end of the day, I'm an entertainer and I wanted people to be entertained while reading the book. So that's when I kind of made the distinction between the terms fairy versus pansy, because pansy is not even really used a lot nowadays. I don't think I've ever really heard it in a long, long time, except, mm-hmm. you know, in reference to the flowers. And by the way, they're tough flowers. I think it's ironic that, you know, pansy was later in the 40s and 50s used disparagingly, but really they are tough as hell flowers, to be honest. So I find that really funny. But drag queens back then, if they were referred to in newspapers, so if you read the back issues of the New York Times, you'll see them referred to as female impersonators or male impersonators. So we're talking about drag queens and drag kings. Colloquially, they would be referred to as bulldaggers or bulls for the women, and they were also referred to as fairies or pansies in terms of the men. And so I figured, since fairy is still used today as a slur in some respects, mm-hmm. I wanted to downplay that word and kind of dial up pansy. And I could justify it historically because in the 30s, that was what was going to be rising to prominence in terms of the pansy craze before the moralists came in and kind of wiped it out.
Yeah. Well, I think fairy is one of those things where two gay men can call each other a fairy. And in your book, straight people refer to as normals. They're not allowed mm-hmm. to call us fairies. Very big difference.
Big difference.
Any word, it really comes down to how it's used. That makes the difference.
Absolutely.
So a lot of the stuff I really want to get into, because there's so much history in this novel that I just found a lot of fun. Let's just go ahead and start with the story. Should we talk about the story, or should we start talking about Dash?
Yeah, absolutely. Dash Parker is our hero. He is a fallen Manhattan socialite. He grew up in privilege. He grew up in the gilded townhouses in the early 1900s. And he is an unusual character for the time because he recognized his sexuality as being something different. He actually fell in love with his family's tailor, a Spanish tailor. Oh, my, what controversy. Actually, excuse me, he was Catalan, not Spanish, Catalan. I would get sacked for the differences. But yeah, he fell in love, and he was inspired by his younger sister, who died in the 1918 flu epidemic back then. And his sister had recognized who he was, I think, long before Dash did, and said, "You should live your life your way." And so, spurred on by the death of his sister, he decided to go down to the village, Greenwich Village, which was a queer haven at the time, still is. And he was going to try to live his life that way. And a couple of twists and turns have happened. And he's opened up a speakeasy behind the tailor shop called Pinstripes, because we got to love a good pun. We in the queer community love our puns. So I had to bring that through. He's opened this speakeasy and trying to live a life of good music, good gin, and good men.
I love the speakeasy behind the tailor shop. I thought that was awesome. The only thing I've ever seen from that era that I can think of is for a short time, I worked for a real estate agent. He would have like two opening houses at the same time, and I would work one of them while he worked the other. And one was in a mansion in an area here called Los Feliz, which a lot of people outside mm-hmm. LA have never heard of. There's some beautiful mansions there. And one was this mansion that was absolutely incredible. And you go down to the basement and everything's normal, but then all of a sudden you can turn these things around and there's a hidden door and open up the wall and you have an actual bartender behind the bar. And I was thinking of that house the whole time I'm reading about the speakeasy and having to get in. So that was all a lot of fun. So tell us, Dash, he's running this speakeasy, but that's not what all the story is about. What happens here?
We open with an outsider has found his way into the club. And by outsider, meaning someone who is not queer, very obviously. And during this time period, it was illegal. The law was degenerate disorderly conduct. And that was passed around, I believe, 1924, 1925. So Dash could not only be arrested for running a speakeasy, which was against the Volstead Act, commonly known as Prohibition, but he could also be arrested for this degeneracy. And so there's this man who's in his club looking for a drag queen. He is looking specifically for a drag queen. Now, it's very obvious that he does not have good intentions. And so Dash is going to try to find a way to kind of protect this person. And it turns out that this person is looking for the drag queen to get to his brother named Carl. Carl Mueller is the boy who is in the club. Walter Mueller is the outsider or the blue nose, someone who is a teetotaler, believes in Prohibition. And Dash is going to try to hide Carl from Walter because he has been there himself. He feels a kinship with Carl as someone who is a young queer man who is, you know, trying to live his life and is trying to get out from under a very oppressive family. And so he tries to hide him. He hides him with a friend of his in Harlem. And so Dash is, again, very unique for the time period. He is friends with people of different races. He is friends with someone who is an African-American woman who is a performer in Harlem. And he tries to hide Carl up there. And of course, it all goes wrong because this is a crime story. So nothing ever goes right in a straight line, quite in a straight line. And unfortunately, Carl is murdered. And so now we've got a situation where Dash feels very guilty because he tried to protect this boy and he couldn't. But then Walter comes back around, the brother, and blackmails him and his friends to find the drag queen that he was originally looking for because he's going to enact a little bit of vengeance. And so now we've got a dual-sided story where we want to, one, figure out what happens to Carl, because Dashville is responsible. But then we've also got to get out from underneath Walter, this blackmailer. So it's the reluctant detective times two and trying to figure out a way around this and following the path of Carl's life and figuring out who was in his life and all the people involved. And people are not quite what they seem, as we find out in several parts of this story.
Well, one thing I found interesting about Pinstripe, since we're specifically talking about Dash right now, is that was brought up that, well, actually, let me go back one step back. You talked about Carl or Walter, while looking for his brother, said he was looking for a pansy, not a drag queen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
You said he was looking for a drag queen. No, he wasn't. He was looking for a pansy.
For a pansy.
So, again, you stayed true to the time. But now going back to what I was about to say is, Pinstripes, what I found interesting is it had a lot of things morally reprehensible about it. First of all, it was a speakeasy to begin with. Mm-hmm. Second of all, it happened to be a club for queer folk at that time. And then it was brought up that the other thing that was immoral and illegal was that the band that played there, they were black.
Yeah, highly, highly illegal.
I want to hear a little bit more about that. Is, you know, we always think of the South as being prejudiced. And I lived in North Carolina, and trust me, there were a lot of class members I went to school with that were in the Klan. So it is very prevalent in the South. But people think it never happens in the North or never did. Can you talk about that during that era?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, The city, like a lot of American cities at that time period, were still somewhat segregated. So, you know, you had Harlem, which was where a good majority of the Black population lived, as well as the Italian population and other nationalities as well. But for example, in the Times Square's Broadway theaters, Black patrons could only be in the balcony. They could never be on the floor. So the audiences could not mix. The Cotton Club, which is a famous Harlem nightclub that I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of, the performers were all people of color, but the audience was all white. And the club that, you know, was being drawn in, you know, for like Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. So there was a lot of segregation and a lot of laws against it. I believe the Cabaret Act was something that was passed that really kind of put the kibosh on a lot of interracial mixing. Now, what was interesting about Prohibition is that it drove a lot of things underground. And so people started to do a little mixing and matching, as it were. And so a lot of whites, they were called downtowners, would go up to Harlem because it was the kind of taboo thing to do. They actually called it slumming. You would go slumming up there. And so you would actually kind of sell tickets to kind of do that so they could go to certain clubs. But there were clubs that would start to mix audiences. And there were clubs that also started to mix band members. You know, I think what was here, what was really illegal was not only was the band Black, but actually two members, if I remember right, it was a mix of white and Black. And that certainly wasn't done on the stage. So, you know, it's really interesting. I think it surprised a lot of people. A lot of readers have commented on that, that they didn't recognize that even though it was New York City and it was the North, that segregation still occurred. And it did. It was not necessarily as violent as the South was, you know, especially during the 20s. We had the rise of the KKK. We had the rise of the Jim Crow laws and everything. But yeah, it wasn't... it wasn't the utopia that most people would think of. And so actually a lot of the great migration that occurred, a lot of Blacks were really disappointed when they got here because they still faced oppression. They still faced lower wages. Harlem, believe it or not, was predominantly white before the African-American community started moving in. And so all the whites fled, and the buildings, which were owned predominantly by white landlords, jacked the rent so that way people had to cram in more tenants into the buildings than the white tenants have done it. And then, of course, people spun it and go, well, see, it's the slum, but yet it's the slum because of the white landlords who basically rigged the system. So there was a lot of that still going on in that day. So I wanted to try to kind of capture how it was still taboo. And to show kind of what a boundary breaker Dash Parker is, and the fact that he was willing to kind of look beyond the norms of his day, not just in terms of his own sexuality, but also in terms of race.
Yeah, it's really surprising to me to hear that Los Angeles during that era was very conservative. Hollywood was an ultra-conservative neighborhood. In fact, the Hollywood sign, the history behind the Hollywood sign, it used to be, say, Hollywood Land. And I think a lot of people know that it used to be Hollywood Land. And Hollywood Land was at the bottom of the hill, a housing development for whites only. And I've seen the ads for Hollywood Land, and without saying it, it was not hidden. It basically said, you'll get away from the Mexicans and the Black folk, without really saying that. It was just blatantly obvious that that's what they were talking about. So I have gotten used to living in Los Angeles as long as I have at this point, I've gotten used to realizing that this was a pretty conservative city. The state itself is still pretty conservative. But I wasn't expecting that with New York. You know, I think of the cabarets and you hear so much, and it was surprising to me.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that there were different sections of Harlem, and there were wealthy immigrants, and there were also wealthy African-American populations as well. So in West Harlem, and particularly, there were a lot of mansions. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine Manhattan if you see it now, because it just feels like it's row after row after row of buildings. But, you know, there was a point where Uptown, or, you know, Northern Manhattan was wilderness, or it looked more like the suburbs, and it doesn't look like the urban center that it is today. And there were a lot of mansions up there, and the mansions were built around the late 1800s, about early 1900s. And so when some of the white citizens of those mansions left, there were some wealthy African-Americans who could move in. And they would have parties and what have you, and lived in these gorgeous mansions. And some of them are still around today. I actually made a fictionalized version based off of two, kind of a mishmash of the two, but the architecture is just wonderful and beautiful. So there were like these kind of two different types of Harlems. You know, you had the wealthy Harlem, you had the poorer Harlem. You also had at the time, like the nightclub culture and the cabaret culture. There was a lot of blues clubs, and the blues were extremely queer back then. And a lot of the recordings were done by a lot of queer women and lesbian women. So we're talking Ma Rainey here, and of course, Gladys Bentley, who I based a character off of, which I'm sure we'll get to L Train in a minute. But so it was interesting. So you had that kind of queer culture that was there. And of course, you know, Langston Hughes was part of the queer community, and a bunch of other poets and writers. But then you also had this other fraction of Harlem, which I didn't delve too much into this book, but will be in some of the other books coming up, where they wanted it to be seen as respectable. So they did not like the nightlife of Harlem. They especially did not like the queer population of Harlem. They didn't want them to get press. They didn't want them to get attention, because they wanted to be seen as, you know, fine, upstanding citizens who didn't break the law. So it was a really interesting time period. You saw this in other neighborhoods as well, where there's this kind of push-pull between kind of progressive attitudes and more traditional attitudes. And I felt like that was kind of a nice not allegory, but a nice parallel to kind of what's happening now. And it's interesting to see how in American history, we've always had that, this sense of progressives wanting to push the envelope, push what is acceptable, and people kind of backlashing against it. But yeah, there were definitely two sets of Harlems, and it was great to see, you know, to learn about it, because it just makes it multidimensional. And unlike what we learn in history, we seem to kind of look at things in a very flat way, and not seeing as something that's a bit more dimensional and a bit more complicated than what's been presented to us.
You mentioned L Train. You mentioned who she's based after, which was a question I was going to ask you. Now, I want you to elaborate a little further. I want you to explain to folks who L Train is and who you based her on.
Absolutely. L Train is one of my favorite characters. I love her so much.
Mine too.
She's so wonderful. She's going to have a more of a starring role in the books to come, because she's just such a big personality. So L Train is a performer at the Oyster House, which is up on 133rd in Harlem. And she plays the piano, and she is a big, broad-shouldered, butch African-American woman. And she dresses in men's tuxedos, complete with the tails and the top hat. And she will perform in this cabaret, which is a bit of a queer cabaret, which also has an interracial audience, so highly controversial. And she will vulgarize popular cabaret songs. And she took a little ditty, which was written in 1919, called Alice Blue Gown, which was about Alice Roosevelt's famous blue dress. And I won't spoil it, but she makes it about something completely different, and something that you can't repeat in front of your mother.
And I can assure you, people were not playing that on the Victrolas. The lyrics are in the book, and yeah, it wasn't being played
enough. Yeah, it's actually based off of a song that Gladys Bentley did, actually. So the last verse is actually a verbatim what she performed. It was actually written down in a book, so I found it, but I had to elaborate on some of the other verses. But yeah, so she's based off of Gladys Bentley, as I mentioned before. And Gladys Bentley was, you know, same physical build, same stage demeanor. She wore men's tuxedos, complete with the top hat, and she would perform at the Clam House. So the Oyster House is my fictionalized version of the Clam House, that was also in Harlem. And she would play a piano. She had this big booming voice. She would vulgarize popular cabaret songs, but then she would also make you cry. And she would do a version of St. James Infirmary Blues that would just make you weep. And so she was very famous in the 1920s. She actually had her own club in Harlem in the 1930s called the Club Ugandi. And she would perform with a full band. She would also perform with a chorus of pansies or drag queens behind her. She performed all over the country. She went out to LA and she was a personality. There are some recordings of her that are available actually on streaming. Some of her 20s are recordings.
I want to get now to the other neighborhood in the story that you brought up a little earlier, and that was Greenwich Village. And you brought up that was a gay community. I think of it as a very popular gay community in the 60s and 70s, and you're saying it was at that time as well. But the way you described it, it reminded me of Paris during that era, with the Impressionist painters and that sort of thing. Am I right that it was very similar in that sense? And can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It was very similar. It was called Bohemia back in the day, and that was where all the artists would go. And so you had your painters, you had your poets, you had your writers, you know, your sculptors and what have you. And they all kind of congregated around the village. And then within that, there was a lot of queer and LGBTQ plus culture that was occurring. So there were lesbian tea rooms, as well as queer and gay speakeasies. Greenwich Village was an artistic center. It was called Bohemia. It was known as Bohemia amongst a lot of New Yorkers. Again, very similarly to when white downtowners would go up to Harlem, they would slum it. If you went down to the village, you were also slumming it. It was a big immigrant neighborhood as well. So we had lots of Irish and lots of Italians there. Not so much Germans, although they actually started off down there and then moved up a little bit more to the Upper East Side. But yes, it was kind of a mix of cultures, as well as a mix of professions. So you had, you know, the artistic set, but then you also had the dock workers who were there. And it was a bit of a rough and tumble neighborhood. There was one bar that was a real speakeasy that had sawdust on the floor. And it also had an actual stuffed, if I remember this right, a stuffed monkey behind the bar who was a famous circus monkey that traveled around. The name escapes me, but I'll let you know it when I remember it. But it was there behind the bar, and it was a rough kind of bar. It was, you know, you went in there and you didn't mess around. And so, you know, if you did, you would be shown the door fairly quickly. And I believe that bar was called the Golden Goose. There was a Golden Goose out front of it. But yeah, so there was a lot of it still today, just a car crash of different types of cultures and different types of people and different types of professions. And so I wanted to try to reflect all of that in some way, shape, or form. And also, your political anarchists were there, your socialists were there, people who were not fans of the capitalists and what have you. So one of the things that I found just investigating this time period is 100 years later, we're arguing about the same stuff. So we're arguing about the role of women, you know, it may shock some of your younger listeners, but, you know, women got to vote, you know, a scant 6 years, 5.5 years before this story starts. And they were voting. And oh, my God, they're going to vote. And what was going to happen to our political system? And what was the role of women? And should they be working? Why are they working? What do they want to work for? You know, and, you know, the immigrants, people coming in, you know, we just fought this world war where we don't want the immigrants who were leaving Europe. So we passed the Immigration Act of 1924, which basically, unless you were British, you weren't getting in the country. We were arguing about the role of work, the role of millionaires. Harding and Coolidge were very much pro-millionaire. Everyone else was against the millionaires. So I just look at what we are arguing about and talking about now. And it's pretty much very similar in terms of subject matter, in terms of tone. The details may have changed, but we're still arguing about the same stuff, which on one hand is kind of depressing that in 100 years, we're still there. But it is kind of fascinating to see how this, again, push-pull, you know, it's like three steps forward, two steps back, three steps forward, two steps back. And that's just kind of the history of America in a nutshell. But yeah, the village was a very vocal place. And a very interesting place, artistic place, and diverse place.
But isn't also kind of hip and trendy? I'm sure that everywhere in New York is expensive, but I know it is skyrocketed. I think it's the place to live. Am I right?
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is before, when it was just the Bohemians, it was kind of dirt cheap. And then the wealthy people started to move in towards Washington Square Park and around that area. And it was starting to drive the rents up, which of course vexed the Bohemians to no end, and how they were just like, why are you making it more expensive to live here? Again, it's again, nothing new under the sun. But when I read the letter sections of the New Yorker or the New York Times, the New York residents were still complaining about the same stuff. The subway doesn't run, the buses are awful, the rent is too expensive, and we hate the landlords. And again, 100 years later, it's the same it's the same thing over and over again. You know, we're pushing the real New Yorkers out for these fake New Yorkers to move in. So, you know, in the Village, there was a lot of ire against the wealthy coming in, because they're like, okay, you're just pretending to be Bohemians because it's the hip thing to do, but you're not one of us, and you're driving the real people out of it. So that, by the way, is the same thing now in New York. You know, we've got basically a lot of international wealthy money coming in, forcing the real New Yorkers out. Whereas, like, great, you have a tax write-off and a home, you're here 3 weeks out of the year. The rest of us have to now live off the island. Same stuff. Nothing new. Nothing new under the sun.
And it's very similar out here. The Castro and West Hollywood. Well, the Castro was, it wasn't a rundown area, but it wasn't exquisite. And gay folks moved in and started building up a community and cleaning up these beautiful, absolutely gorgeous homes. And all of a sudden, those homes are worth a fortune and the Castro is dying. I have so many friends that have left the Castro and moved to Palm Springs. One, it's just too expensive, and two, it's not the same. Now, if you're in the Castro, you know you're in the gay community. Don't get me wrong. But it's not as solid as it used to be. And it's very similar with West Hollywood. I forget what West Hollywood's name used to be. It was at the edge of Los Angeles, and it's its own separate town. But it was kind of, because it was at the edge of the county, they could get away with things. And then it developed into West Hollywood, is what we know as the gay area. And the same thing's happening there. I used to spend a lot of time in West Hollywood. Now I live quite a ways away, and my husband and I drove through it, and we're like, where did all these condos come from? And all these straight people with their strollers, you know, what's going on here? We're seeing that happen everywhere. And I'm curious, it sounds like that same thing is happening to Harlem. It's redeveloping, am I correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah. There's a lot of gentrification happening, and it's a big topic here in New York. Harlem is definitely being gentrified. Brooklyn, areas of Brooklyn are being gentrified. And so it's pushing a lot of those kind of communities out. So there's a conversation happening about, well, on one hand, we all like economic prosperity. But on the other hand, though, like, if we just homogenize everything, like, you lose the flavor of what makes those neighborhoods so special and so wonderful. And also those people who have lived there before, like, where, you know, why do they have to get pushed out of their homes? Mm-hmm. Like, that's their home, you know? So there's a lot of conversation. I won't say a great conversation. It's a tense conversation, but I think it's a needed one to be like, okay, how do we find the balance? Because it can't be, you know, this extreme of, you know, we put in a Pottery Barn and a Starbucks and mm-hmm. everything is just too expensive and only one group of people can live there, you know, of a certain economic class. Like, that doesn't seem to be a good thing. So, but it's definitely happening here. And I'm hoping that we can find some solution, because to me, New York is a very unique city. It's a very diverse city. And I mean, every culture in the world is practically here. But, you know, if we go and replace it with TGI Fridays, then it's just going to be a really overexpensive suburb. And who the hell wants that?
Exactly. So I
would love New York to stay New York. And I want it to stay weird and wonderful and diverse. And so I'm hoping that we can find some sort of solution, because, I mean, this city really is fabulous. I've lived in a couple of different towns, and this is by far one of my favorites. And for anyone who wants to visit, but please don't go to Times Square. That's not New York. That's for tourists. I'll email me. I'll tell you where to go. So you can support New Yorkers and support New York neighborhoods.
If you go to Hawaii and only stay in Honolulu, what the hell? You might as well go to Miami.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about happening in Harlem is, you know, I think it's happening in every city. The area that I mentioned earlier about Westlake that had the park is actually now called MacArthur Park, that area. And it's where, because the rent was so low, it's a lot of first generation immigrants that live there. But all of a sudden, now we're seeing condos being built. And I have no doubt in my mind, that's pretty much what it's going to be in 10 years. And what's going to happen to those other folks? Where are they going to go? And it concerns me. I hope it's not the streets, because it's not cheap to live in LA.
It's not cheap to live in LA.
Well, I could go on and on about this. I could just make this the history show, which I've actually considered as a podcast. If I ever do that, I'll have you back on. Well, I may have you back on anyway when your next book comes out. And I do want to talk about that. You have another one coming out that you're working on. Mm-hmm. And The Blind Tiger is going to be the next Hidden Gotham novel. When can we expect that?
We're expecting it in December. So that's our date. So fairly fast. But the reason for that is because actually in writing The Double Vice, when I first started it, it was actually three books in one. I realized I had too much, because there was so much to play with and so much to work with. And so actually The Double Vice is one third. And so the Blind Tiger is going to be the second third. And then there's going to be another book that will be the third third. So that hence the speed on it. But we're aiming for Christmas. So it'll be a great stocking stuffer. And I'm looking forward to it. And I'm about neck deep in it. But it's going to be a little bit of a different story. So Dash Parker's still going to be our hero. But here we're getting into the world of poisoned booze and chemists. And something that I've teased in this book that, you know, I'm going to fully flesh out in The Blind Tiger and really kind of delve into more of the prohibition side of it. And actually dealing with the medical examiner's office. So I'm going to start talking about Charles Norris, who was our coroner in New York at Bellevue Hospital. And he and his partner, Alexander Gettler, actually created the processes that would actually become forensic medicine and in crime solving. And so it was that office. I read a great book called The Poisoner's Handbook by Deborah Blum. I believe I'm saying her last name correctly. If I'm not, I'm sorry, Deborah. But it's a great book, and I believe it was made into a miniseries that just talks about how they discovered how human beings died in the city. Because back then, coroners were paid by the body, and everyone was corrupt. Shocker. So, you know, the coroners would be like, yeah, just pay me whatever, and I'll just process the body. So they'd be like, yeah, this person died, you know, falling out of a window, and he was shot. You know, like, so there wasn't a lot of ethical considerations going on, so... Not to, you know, derail a little bit, but we're going to be dealing with them. And that's a fascinating history in and of itself. So I can't wait to talk about that a little bit later when that book comes out. But so, yeah, we're going to be dealing with, unfortunately, some dead flappers, some poisoned booze. Where is it coming from? And how do we stop it? So that's coming up in December.
December 2021. And of course, I can't let you go before we do Awkward Questions Authors Get. I can't believe I almost forgot that.
Yeah, no, I have. I'm ready for my awkward author question. I can't wait.
Okay. So step back. I'm going to spin the wheel here and we're going to find your question. Okay, Chris, I've got your question. When are you going to write a New York Times bestseller?
Oh gosh, I hope I've already done so. that's a great question. Sure. The next one, The Blind Tiger, that's the one that's going to hit the charts. That's the one that's going to hit the charts because you're all are going to buy it for Christmas. It's going to make a great gift, especially for your conservative aunts and uncles. You know what's funny about this, the author questions, awkward author questions, because I used to be a musician, obviously. I won an award for a song. I didn't make a dime off that song, but I won an award, so I'm going to champion it every chance I get. But we would always get, like, we would always compare, like, the awkward singer-songwriter questions you'd get, you know, and some of the stuff that they would ask you, at club owners do, you know. And I think one of the last authors you interviewed on the show, what was it like? Have you written anything that I heard of? I've gotten that one in a music section. Have you done anything I've heard of? Have you done anything I've seen? You're like, good grief. Okay. Yes, that's why I'm playing your dive bar, which has 15 drunks in it. Yes, that's exactly why I'm here.
It's like, oh yeah, you know what? I think my next book, I'll write a New York Times bestseller. It's about time I did one of those. You know?
About time I did one of those. Well, if I did, I'd probably have to set it in World War II, because World War II sells like hotcakes. So I'll be like, done. We'll write about Nazis. That seems to be the du jour for historic crime fiction bestsellers.
Okay, Chris Holcomb, his first novel is The Double Vice. I highly recommend it. It's available now. And thank you, Chris, and for being on the show. And folks, you know where it's going to be. It's all going to be on the show notes to his website and to buy the book. And thank you very much, Chris, for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. And thank you, Justine, for finding my book. I don't know how she did, but I'm so glad she did, because then we got introduced. So this has been an absolute ball.
Lord only knows where she finds these things. And one last reminder to the listeners. Next Saturday, July 24th, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, Queer Writers of Crime is going to be live for the first time on TuneIn Radio, part of the Pride 48 network. And as I said before, we're going to have a special guest reviewer because Justine can't make it. And Marco Romante will be on with some very special news.